This is a session by Rich Anderson and Leo Bustad on forgiveness versus revenge and trust and all. And a lot of people here probably wonder how do they go about it? Getting a list of speakers and programs, and is there any rhyme or rhythm or forethought to the various subjects that are presented here as you look on the board each day? Well, there is some. There's a meeting every week by the faculty and others to try to do something about this. And this particular one has, I think, special significance to me for various reasons. A lot of things happened on the way to the office, sort of thing. We have some interconnected programs this past week. Of course, I talk about animals, and we can learn a lot from animals, as you've probably already realized listening to me for the last couple of weeks. And one of the remarkable things is forgiveness. You've all met my wife's hearing dog. Her name is Bridget. I call her Dingbat. But that's before we trained her. I call them the way I see them. But she was trained to be, she's now a certified hearing dog. Now, if the chief and I come home 5 hours late from feeding that dog, is it going to bite us when we come in the door? Happier to see us than if we came home on time, probably. And I don't know any Homo sapiens that do that. That's true for a lot of animals. And you can be gone 5 minutes or 2 days. They welcome you back. They forgive you for a lot of things that you do badly for them. So that's part of the background for this. And I felt a need to, we all need a lesson in forgiveness all the time. And revenge, one of the things as an administrator for much of my life, I've always tried to tell my associates that revenge is not our assignment on planet Earth. It's the biggest waste of time there is. And we talked about here during my time, we talked about loneliness, prisons, anger, and now forgiveness. And there's a lot of relationship with this. Rich talked about anger in a truly remarkable session last night. I was really amazed at it. And I also had an experience, two other experiences that I just want to mention. On the way to Alaska a couple of weeks ago, it was a full plane, and I ended up with a middle seat. Somebody messed up, but which I don't like sitting in middle seats. But there was a fellow on my right. I engaged him in conversation. He'd been all over the world, especially in the Middle East. He sells stuff to oil fields all over the world. Had fantastic experience. But one of his favorite places to go is to Alaska. And he said, now I got to tell you about one of my last trips to Alaska. So I stopped outside of the park, McKinley Park, a town there. And I engaged a fellow in a conversation, a kid. You always ask him, how long have you been in Alaska? He'd been there 6-8 months or something. Where are you from? Detroit. Oh, what are you doing there? Well, he says, my folks kicked me out. I was into drugs and narcotics, and that's why I'm bringing this up, because that's your life, in a way, dealing with these people. His folks just told him to hit the road, and that was it. So he hitchhiked out of Detroit, caught a ride with a trucker, ended up in this town in Alaska. He arrived there, and the service station man says, well, you look kind of cold. You better go in and get a cup of coffee. And when he came out, the service station man says, you want a job? This kid thought he has to be out of his tree, you know. You don't ask a guy if he wants a job before you find out about his history. He wasn't interested in history. He just asked him if he wanted a job. How much is it paid? $200 a week plus room and board. Well, this sort of amazed him. And he asked him, you know, what he did and all. And he says, the first thing, though, he says, I'll get you some coats and warm boots and gloves and stuff. And he says, and if that wasn't enough, he told this guy. He says, just a couple of weeks ago, this guy's son was in a drawing on a homestead. And he asked this kid if he wouldn't be his partner in it. He says, I still can't believe this, that they just trusted me. And nobody else in my life has ever trusted me. And he says, I could never lie or be deceitful to these people. And he says, I think I'll stay in Alaska forever. I might visit the lower 48, but only for a visit. That impressed me. The other thing that brought this about was, and very speedily now, I'm taking too long on this. I was speaking at a graduation at Oregon State University a few weeks ago. And my host said, you want to go with us to the Methodist Church? They have an interesting folk mass in the morning. And I went, it was a very impressive service. A very articulate pastor. Well, both of them were articulate. The senior pastor gave a talk on six reasons why people don't forgive. And it impressed me. So I asked him, you know, he mentioned a book, and I asked him, what's the name of the book? Well, he gave the name to me wrong, but so I had a little time trouble getting it. But I called up the bookstore in the seminary in St. Paul a few days before I got here, and then they delivered it to me. It's called Learning to Forgive, Doris Donnelly. And I'm going to share some of that with you. The other thing I wanted to tell, I forgot to mention my prisons and in loneliness. And it's also related to this, because they're all tied in, and I think it's shown most vividly. What I failed to bring out is one of the books that's really impressed me, and because of my experience in prison camp, was Solzhenitsyn's A One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And he tells about this fellow there, that loneliness in a Siberian prison camp had nothing to do with barbed wire and the very difficult conditions of the camp. Because this person, Alyoshka, and also his attitude towards his captors, Alyoshka had the secret. He had the scripture that he had hidden away in his mattress, which he read every day. And so he was never alone, and he had the lesson in forgiveness. It took the anger out of him, and he was forgiving. All right, now, the book. Not until 1966 were there a separate entry in the Reader's Guide to Periodic Literature under the word failure. Not on the human-animal bond either. Pet facility therapy, but I'm working on it. Up to that time, anyone searching for failure would find failure, see success. Preoccupation with success, striving for it, attaining it, preserving it, obscures the reality of failure in human life and obscures the need for forgiveness, too, because forgiveness presupposes failure and attempts to be creative about it. Can you hear me back there? Yeah. Forgiveness is an invitation to redeem failure. Without forgiveness, we would never be released from the consequences of what we have done or what has been done to us. And our capacity, and this is this statement is from an outstanding person named Hannah Arendts, died some years ago. I think she was at University of Chicago. She, among other things, she wrote a book on the human condition.
Hannah Arendt.
Arendt. That's right. A-H-R-E-N-D-T.
Close.
I remember reading this book. It made a big impression on me. One sentence out of it. Our capacity to act would, as it were, be confined to one single deed from which we would never recover. Yet for whatever allure and redemptive value forgiveness possesses, it is also so disturbingly unreasonable as to make us question its feasibility and the world's readiness for it. And it ain't ready. A forgiveness that claims our sins, though scarlet, to be made white as snow, is a proclamation of so radically kind as to border on the fantastic, the unbelievable. A fellow named McIntosh once asked whether forgiveness was immoral, unnecessary, and or impossible. At one time or another, most of us have asked similar questions about forgiveness, and this book hopes never to lose sensitivity to those questions. As well as establishing awareness of the difficulties connected with forgiveness, these pages deal mostly with the formidable power that forgiveness exercises on our lives, which enable us to acknowledge that the decisions of human life, even when they turn out badly, are not above repair. So we go from there. And some examples on this. Forgiveness is part of a process that begins with a hurt and ends as its final and long-range goal with the event of reconciliation, or reconciliation. To reconcile means to bring together that which belongs together, but which is apart. It works only when we pause to forgive, only when we become aware of the depth of the offense against us, so that we can forgive with all our wits about us and ensure enduring peace. And he said, bypassing forgiveness spares us. It allows us to suppress and repress our hurts and to bury our resentments. The pattern of behavior that inspires people inspires nations too. After barbaric and inhuman behavior among countries, we have seen those same nations sit down at the conference table and sign treaties in a noble tribute to reconciliation. We've seen those very same truces violated before the ink is dry, when countries have not forgiven before reconciliation is attempted. And it's important to point this out. And one of the things, some of you who are older, will recall at the time of the Nixon administration, and then he was replaced by Gerald Ford. And he opened the floodgates, really, of criticism and popular censure when, as president, when as president, he pardoned Richard Nixon. President Ford later defended his action by claiming it an act of kindness and charity, which I'm sure he sincerely believed. And well, it might have been, as the author says. Yet the nation was not ready for that gesture. And 3 years later, there were those willing to suggest that his act of kindness may well have cost him the election to be president. In theological terms, we could say that what President Ford did was to offer to reconcile ex-President Nixon with the nation before its citizens were able to forgive. Reconciliation seemed inappropriate, like an arm around the shoulder of a wounded country before the shrapnel could be picked out and the wound was clean and bandaged. That is, while a nation waited healing, it seemed premature and peremptory, and the nation sensed the discrepancy. Whatever technical and legal distinctions were made between guilt and pardon, there seems to be little doubt that the mood of the country was not ready to be reconciled until the people could at least touch base with forgiveness. This does not have to be viewed as vindictive, vengeful, retaliatory need. It is likely to have been none of these things, and more a need for a fitting pause before trust and love could take root again. And you've heard it a lot of times when people have set up a party. They're going to have a great party. And somebody says, if they're coming, count me out. The need for forgiveness is pervasive and constant. Where at present, there is a quality to life that is tensionless and graceful. Where it is missing, there are gnarled and hardened lives frequently sloshing around in self-pitying, self-righteous behavior. And then she goes on. Some of you have probably read, and it's in the bookstore here, Corrie ten Boom's book, The Hiding Place. It's a very difficult time in World War II, and her sister Betsy died in a concentration camp. And Corrie ten Boom went around a lot, not only reading, I mean, people became very interested in her when they read her book. She went around lecturing and preaching on the need to forgive our enemies. And the struggle with the command to forgive was brought home in a very stunning force one night when she was speaking as a guest lecturer. She was greeted by a man whom she recognized as the SS guard in the shower room in the processing center at Ravensbrück. "How grateful I am for your message, Fraulein," this fellow said. "To think that, as you say, he has washed my sins away." And suddenly it was all there, the room full of mocking men, the heaps of clothing, Betsy's pain-blanched face. And I recall in some of the prison camps I was in, you'd have to probably form a long line to take care of some of them as soon as the expected armistice was declared. There was going to be a lot of competition for who'd get at some of those people first. "This fellow's hand was thrust out to shake mine," said Terry Corrie ten Boom. "And I, who had preached so often to the people in Bloemendal the need to forgive, kept my hand at my side. Even as the angry, vengeful thoughts boiled through me, I saw the sin of them. Jesus Christ had died for this man. Was I going to ask for more? Lord Jesus, I prayed, forgive me and help me to forgive him. I tried to smile. I struggled to raise my hand. I could not. I felt nothing, not the slightest spark of warmth or charity. And so again I breathed the silent prayer, Jesus, I cannot forgive him. Give me your forgiveness. And as I took his hand, a most incredible thing happened. From my shoulder, along my arm, and through my hand, a current seemed to pass from me to him, while into my heart sprang a love for this stranger that almost overwhelmed me. And so I discovered that it is not on forgiveness anymore than on our goodness that the world's healing hinges, but on his. And when he tells us to love our enemies, he gives us along with the command, the love itself. Corrie ten Boom's story tells us that the practice of forgiveness is harder than its theory. And that's true with a lot of things. I used to always be very flippant about people when they lost someone close to them, like a mate and a child. You got to carry on. You got to carry on. I learned the hard way that's a hard task when I lost big. This woman took the business of forgiveness seriously. She did not pretend reconciliation. She considered the depths of her hurts, her traumas, her fears, her wounds. She took inventory. She felt, she hurt, and she said in her speechlessness and temporary paralysis that she needed empowerment from a source not her own to do what had to be done. And so we move from there. And of course, she goes into a lot of the interesting stories, like the waiting father, the prodigal son, who was a real goof-off and a real louse. But the father, on welcoming back, he didn't put up any stipulations. But his son did. And I have a lot of sympathy for the elder son. I mean, he probably ended up having to work twice as hard because this goof-off brother of his went off into a far country and wasted his substance. I mean, he was a louse, huh? And his older brother, I have more sympathy for him because he had to work through this, like Corrie ten Boom did. So don't be too hard on this guy. Now, we hope he went through this and finally came around, but I got a lot of sympathy for the older brother. Now, this importance of forgiveness, and we're going to take these points now, and maybe you'll have something to say about them, and I know Rich certainly will, and then he's going to take it on from there. But I'll never forget a story that Ken Erickson, who used to be on the board here, and he wrote a book, a very important book, called The Power of Praise. And he himself has suffered from good positive self-worth. Well, he had reason, a lot of reasons to have a good deal of self-worth, but he was brought up that way. In fact, he's writing a book now and then. And I owe him a few stories, but I told him it's coming. But he tells this very interesting story about two altar boys. Same situation. This in a parish in another country. And the boy drops a cruet of wine. And the priest cuffs him across the head and says, "Leave and never come back. No forgiveness." And this fellow, you all know him. He never did come back to church. It was Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia. In another place, in a large parish, the same thing happened. The altar boy dropped the cruet of wine. And the priest kind of smiled and whispered, he says, "Someday you'll be a priest." Carried on. It was Fulton J. Sheen, one of the great spokesmen for Catholicism and a lot of other people. I used to delight in listening to some of his remarkable sermons, some of the greatest sermons I ever heard. Makes a lot of difference whether you forgive or not. It is probably true that non-forgiveness is the only reasonable way. It honors the emotions. It affirms rather than denies pain and its after effects. And it looks after the person who was damaged in the scuffle. Forgiveness, on the other hand, is unreasonable. Life, of course, is also frequently unreasonable, and so too is God. Children die. Husbands leave their wives, and wives their husbands. Old people die lonely. Floods wipe out communities. Fortunes are passed on to ruthless men and women, and God appears to allow these tragedies without interfering with or countermanding the powers of the world that is ultimately within his control. It is only the person who experiences and survives the unreasonableness of life who can understand the unreasonableness of forgiveness. And I'm going to tell you a story. Very interesting one. This trucker. He was a very experienced trucker. Very mild fellow. One morning he pulled up at a truck stop. Restaurant he often stopped at. Ordered a big breakfast. He was the only one in there. It was fairly early. And just before it was to be served to him, two macho guys pulled up this rest stop. Leather jackets and all. They came in on motorcycles. And they came in and they saw this guy and they says, "Let's fix him." So they sat down, one on either side of them. Of him. And as the food was delivered, a ham and eggs, and fruit juice and coffee, one of them took his coffee, took some of his toast and his ham and ate it, and the guy on the other side took his fruit juice and his eggs and toast and ate it. The guy didn't say anything, sat there for a while, and then he got up, went over and paid the bill and left. And after a while, after these macho guys had talked about this cream puff, this
pansy.
Huh? Pansy. Yeah, this real pansy. Maybe they ordered some more, and they went over to the cash register. There was only two in there. And they says, "Boy, what a wimp, you know, what a pansy." "Yeah," said the cash register guy. "He isn't too good a driver either." He says, "In fact, when he took off of here, he ran over and flattened two motorcycles." Now, I want you to close your eyes because it's going to be a secret ballot. And I want you to hold up your hands, if you think that, boy, these guys had their just desserts and that's the way to handle these kind of guys. Your eyes closed, raise your hands if you believe that.
I think you and I better get out of here while it's still safe.
Huh? Yeah. You see, a lot of times we address these subjects I address a lot of subjects. In fact, when I'm called on to give a sermon or anything, I discuss the issues that are great problems to me. This is not an exception. People don't forgive because the pain is new and deep. And I remember this pastor brought up several examples of this one. And a loving mate is left with three children. The other mate takes off and leaves them there. Is the mate that stays behind ready to forgive this person for all the problems they cause? Or the one where these fellows have been partners for all their life in a very, what appeared to be a successful business. And then one day he finds out the friend is not a friend, but he's essentially taken money out of the till for the last 5 years, and they have to go into bankruptcy, and there's all kinds of bills to pay, and of course his partner can't pay him, so he's mortgaging everything to pay it off, and he can't bring himself to forgive this person. So we have these kind of things. Any of you want to comment on that? Yeah, and Rich is going to have something, and that's well stated. See that? And what Alice has done here is to point out that the Lord says, vengeance is mine. And that was my basis for saying it isn't our assignment. The next one, people don't forgive because of anger, jealousy, and resentment. The lady, and you've had this experience, she's gone around the block three times probably, and finally found a parking place. Huh? And so she pulls up to back in. And a macho young guy with a sports car zooms in and parks there. And she backs up and sees him there. And he smiles at her and throws a kiss. Gets out of his car and leaves. And I mean, she's wicked. She finally finds a parking place quite a ways away, comes back, and lets all the air out of his tires. Jonah did this too. I mean, Jonah was really wicked. He had Ninevitis, a disease. I mean, he was wicked off with Nineveh, and here God was going to forgive these people that shouldn't be forgiven. He had a tough time with that. It's a bad disease, that Ninevitis. And to even make it worse, you know, he wanted fire to consume this whole outfit, but he didn't worry about them. He was more concerned about that plant that grew up to give him shade, and then the sun came out and did it in. He was more shook up about that. Resentment is the opposite of forgiveness. Forgiveness is restorative. Takes the lopsided scales and puts them right again. It doesn't allow for the holding of grudges for retaliatory gestures. It isn't compatible with a resentment that encourages a person to live with unequal scales. That is with disorder and imbalance. If we forgive, I will have to surrender my grudges, the axes I have to grind with you, the scores I want to settle, and the feelings I enjoy being superior to you who committed a fault against me. Not only that, but I will have to wish you well to boot. For the non-forgiver, as for Jonah, this is too much to handle. For the non-forgiver, it is easier to curse than to bless. Another one, people don't forgive because of revenge. He says that isn't the way to go. Another one, people don't forgive because it's socially unacceptable. And there is a reverse pay cost on this. You know, if someone has wronged me, maybe even a lawsuit. And they bring up a case here where I think this person who had quite a bit of money, I think it was a daughter or a niece or something, borrowed a lot of money from him. And she ran into trouble and couldn't pay it off. And so he wanted to collect, so she countersued. And And finally, she realized it was a lost cause, because she really come to her senses, sort of. So she went and appealed to him, and he forgave her this, even in spite of all the things he'd done for her. And what did some people say? He probably forgave her because she was in the right. That's a lot of times what happens. You're vulnerable when that happens. Just like Ninevitis, I mean, they had it coming. She has other very good examples in here which you want to read about. People don't forgive because there's an easier way. It's the scissors approach. You cut them out of your life. And there's a very interesting story in here that she knew these people. And they always wanted to be have recognition for everything. And if you didn't sort of curry favor with them, they'd scissor you out. They'd scissor you out of their lives. And eventually, although she had good relations with him for a while, she apparently had done something and they scissored her out of their lives, just like she was a non-entity. And she goes on, she said, last year the mother of the family died. Weeks later I learned from the clergyman who officiated at the service that the father and the daughters, expecting large crowds to gather to say final farewells, enlisted the assistance of the local police to handle traffic on the morning of the funeral. Telegrams were sent to neighbors who had moved away. Phone calls were made and local motels were alerted to prepare for out-of-town guests the night before the burial. Yet in the end, only the husband, the daughters, the three, their husbands, and a grandchild or two attended the services. People who use scissors in their relationship think they're cutting people out of their lives, while in reality they are cutting themselves out of the human family. Thus they are people who do not only die alone, but whether they know it or not, they live alone as well. And you'll have something to say about that in a little while with that beautiful prayer.
Why
not do it now?
There's an interesting little poem or prayer that I got out of a book called Wishful Thinking by Frederick Buechner. I just thought I'd read it. It says, of the seven deadly sins, anger is probably the most fun. To lick your wounds, to smack your lips over grievances long past, to roll over your tongue the prospect of bitter confrontation to come, to savor the last toothsome morsel of both the pain you are giving and the pain you are getting back. In many ways, it's a feast fit for a king. The chief drawback is that what you are wolfing down is yourself. The skeleton at the feast is you.
Well stated. I think the last one I just want to bring up, and what this pastor did for me, is people don't forgive because of pride. People don't forgive when they have something to lose, especially when that something is pride. And it's partially related to this lady who I mentioned that was owed this money and then sued and all. And she goes on to say, perhaps all of this can be clarified by remembering that forgiveness is a costly business. The pride in us begs for our act of kindness to be recognized and touted from the housetops. No one finds it simple to bury the hatchet and not make a virtue of burying it, and still less to refrain from marking the place in the ground. Yet forgiveness asks for no memorials. The forgiver looks beyond what others will say to what is true, and one of the things that happens in forgiveness is that a fresh and rarefied form of love is exercised, one whose reward far exceeds the praise of those who do not or cannot understand. And now Rich is going to cover many other points, like when people don't forgive.
Okay. Just quickly, I'll cover a couple things, and then I think we'll give us some time for questions and discussion. I think there's a lot of biblical directives for us about forgiveness, a lot of biblical directives about what to do with anger and resentment. I'm not sure where it is in the Bible, but it says don't, I think it's in Matthew somewhere, it says don't let the sun set on your anger. I think is a real good directive about what we, Christ is telling us to do when we're angry. Directly deal with it, handle it, work it out, resolve it before the end of the day. If you take it with you, if you take it to bed with you, if you sleep on it, you're stuffing it, you're bottling it up inside, and you're turning it into resentment. It's old, it's not appropriate the next day, it's further removed from the situation. It's all the tougher to go back and bring it up and talk it out and resolve it. It becomes resentment that we bottle up inside. And basically, in the work that I do, resentment is emotional, psychological, and relationship cancer. In doing treatment for people that are chemically dependent, resentment is one of the major blocks that people find that keeps them from becoming sober, that keeps them from finding a way of life that is happy and satisfying without becoming drunk or using chemicals again. So resentments, I think, are very significant, and basically resentment is simply day-old anger. For some people, they have resentments that they carry around inside of them for months and years. And I think one of the interesting parts about doing counseling and therapy like I do is to help people identify the resentment that they carry with them. And we go through a process of helping them not only identify all of the resentment, which is a lot like going into a fruit cellar and taking inventory of all the jars on the shelf, then to help them work through the process of getting rid of the resentment and being able to forgive and let go. And I think, like the poem I read, the resentment negatively and destructively really only affects the person carrying it around with them. There's a couple other interesting things in the Bible, I think, that give us some good direction. The one in Matthew 5, the 23rd verse, it talks something like, if when you come to the altar to worship you have something against your brother, go first and be reconciled. Then come to the altar and worship. And I think that that's a pretty clear statement by Christ that says, if you're angry with somebody, if you have something against somebody, if you have an unresolved problem or issue out there, when you come to worship, it's going to put a block up there. That resentment, that anger, that old problem that you're chewing on and that you haven't resolved and forgiven is going to become a serious block in your spiritual relationship with God. And obviously for us in chemical dependency treatment, spirituality is a very serious problem, and it becomes real clear that anger can really get in the way of having open spiritual relationships with God, and also get in the way of having open, meaningful relationships with other people and even with yourself. Well, we can get a Bible and look it up. Why don't you get it? It's Matthew 5, 23, I think. My recollection was if...
Yeah, this is Ellen Gamrath who has raised the issue on this.
Yeah. Let's look it up and see. 23? The other thing I think that's real interesting, of course, at some point Christ alludes to the fact that... it has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And I think what he's clearly disputing is the fact that revenge and getting even isn't healthy. And what does he say? He says, but I say, love your enemies and pray for those who do wrong to you. I think that's One of the toughest things about being a Christian is loving those who do wrong, loving your enemies. I find that almost impossible sometimes, and I think for human beings to be able to do that, we really are going to have to rely on God's help to get some of that extra love and willingness to forgive that maybe we are limited and can't even provide. But to be loving towards somebody that's wronged us, to be loving and pray for people that we identify as enemies, I believe is a directive from Christ that we are expected as Christians to do. I think that makes Christianity a tough one. Ellen? Okay, so it says, if your brother has something against you, leave your gift at the altar and go and be reconciled. Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
The issue I think about that is, though, that maybe your brother has something against you, may still be that what you have done needs some act on your part to go and ask your brother to forgive you. But you may have done something that your brother feels hurt or angry towards you for doing, and it may still be my obligation to go to my brother and ask for forgiveness. But somehow, I think what it's saying is that if there's a separation, before you come to worship, go to be reconciled. Because if you bring the separation into worship, it's going to affect your worship and your spiritual life. Okay, what I hear you saying is, in the act of reconciliation, do you have to go to somebody and be reconciled? And I think that that's a judgment call. In my experience, the ideal is if you can sit down with your brother and talk it out, or your sister, and talk it out and be reconciled and forgive. We don't always have the opportunity, or it maybe isn't beneficial or possible to do that. And I think that there are times when it may be real inappropriate to even go and do that. And there are times then that we need to just find other avenues. Sometimes I ask people to sit down and write them out. One of the beneficial things I have people do is to write that person a letter and explain it all completely and bring it to me, and I'll put it in this special mail pouch. The act is that they simply need to verbalize and express and to go through the act of forgiving for themselves. The other person doesn't necessarily ever have to receive it or know about it for it to benefit you. And I have a lot of letters that come, and we mail them down here. And that person
never
benefited.
Leave down there. And they never
They sometime. Get burned up. See, I see that as a very creative opportunity for evangelism. To go to somebody and say, you know, in my experience here, this has been happening and that's been happening, and that's how I've seen it, and this is how I've felt, and I haven't been happy with it, and I felt real uncomfortable and hurt and sad, and I've gotten mad at you, and I've been blaming you for it, and that's not helpful for me, and I feel real sorry for doing that, and I'm real sorry that I've acted this way. And I'm real sorry that I kept it to myself and went home and just chewed on you and blamed you for everything. And you know, I'm half of it. And I really would like you to forgive me for what I've done.
I'm reminded here of the incident out of the Gospel according to Andy Capp. Andy, I don't know if you follow cartoons, but Andy Capp, I mean, he's a ne'er-do-well. He's a real dead-ender. I mean... no good at all, and he has a very wonderful wife named Flo.
And they haven't talked for a couple of days. And he was really in the wrong, but she finally says, 2 whole days without talking. Forgive me, you know, friends. And he was kind of nonplussed, but he says, okay, friends. And as he walks by her on his way, probably to the local pub, she plants a wet, mushy kiss on him and meets his friend just outside the door. And his friend says, I heard that. He says, takes an awful good person to admit when they're wrong. An old handicapped walks a few steps and he says, even takes a better one to admit it when they're not wrong.
I think the issue you brought up earlier about pride, about self-esteem, an awful lot of people, I think, feel real threatened about going to somebody and saying, I'm sorry for what I've done, and being willing to admit some of the secret little resentments and revenges that we keep to ourselves and never tell other people about. You've got to be relatively transparent and willing to take some risk about exposing your lower nature, you know, our inner naughty selves to other people. But for me, I think that's a very valuable behavioral kind of example of forgiveness and Christian belief and faith. I wanted to read a couple other little things. Buechner, again in his book, talks about forgiveness means the freedom again to be at peace with one another and to be glad in each other's presence. I think that the lack of forgiveness is a very, very divisive experience. And it's really what divides a lot of people, is the unwillingness to forgive or the pride that says, I'm not wrong, they're the ones who are wrong. Until they come and admit they're wrong, I won't forgive them. And people will live with barriers and distances and unhappy emotional turmoil between them because of that. And I think there's a certain amount of pride there that says, I'll live with it before I'll ever go back to her and, you know, talk it out and work it out. And there's a lot of blame, that it's her fault or his fault, and until he does this, I'm not going to do anything. I think that both parties suffer and both parties live with the pain. I think there's also a difference between forgiving and forgetting. I know a lot of people who have felt a tremendous amount of pain and a tremendous amount of hurt and have been able, well, like the example of Corrie Ten Boom, have been able eventually to forgive, but they're going to live the rest of their lives with some very deep scars and will never forget. And I don't think that forgiving requires that we be able to forget. I believe that we can forgive people and always remember. The difference is that the memory in our minds can still be very vivid, but the emotional feeling attached to that memory can go. But the forgiveness deals with the emotional aspect of being angry or bitter or hurt, and it helps us resolve the emotional part of the whole experience. But the old video camera on the computer memory up here may never let go of that experience or that memory. What's very interesting is that people who are willing to forgive eventually find themselves losing lots of the memory and gradually forgetting lots and lots more of the situation. And what I think happens is that as long as you hang on to the anger or the resentment or the emotional pain, you continue to fuel the memory.
and you keep it vivid and you keep it alive, when you forgive and get rid of the emotional energy that's involved in the situation, the forgetting tends to fade gradually and slowly. Sometimes it never goes. But for a lot of people, it doesn't matter anymore. And they quit working at remembering. And I think if we understand mental processes, memory is something that if you don't work at it, tends to fade. Anybody remember their locker combination from high school? Yeah, what you're saying is that a lot of people that are very creative or artistic have suffered a lot of pain and misery in their lives, and they're able to turn that around and channel it into a constructive form of artistic expression or creativity or whatever. Sure. Yeah.
No.
Let me quickly.
You say something.
Quickly say one more thing.
Close to the story.
Yeah. To me, I think one of the elements that's real significant is my understanding of God is that God's love is unconditional, and that there is nothing that mankind can do or be that God isn't willing to forgive. And I think that's what Jesus was saying too. He was asked, how often am I to forgive my brother? Or how often am I to forgive the person that wrongs me? Does anybody remember? 70 times 7. Now that isn't 490. I think that's his way of saying forever, infinitely. Forgive forever. And I think that's also a really tough directive for Christians. And that is, not only are we to love our enemies and to pray for those that do wrong to us, but we're to forgive them forever. And I also think that the example of unconditional love is probably idealistically a goal for us as Christians to strive for. I don't think it's possible. I think we all struggle with being very conditional. We forgive if they'll confess, or we'll love if they'll do this or be that way. But I think the ideal for us is to struggle towards being unconditionally loving, unconditionally forgiving. And it's tough. It's obviously impossible for us as human beings because we're not divine. And that may be some of the difference for Christ between being human and divine. Part of his divinity, I believe, was that he was able to be unconditionally loving, unconditionally forgiving. Where we as human beings can't, but can strive for that. A couple questions also that I have are, what is there that you can think of that you would never be willing to forgive? Can you think of anything that you would not be willing to forgive somebody for? I'm not saying that it wouldn't be painful, wailing, gnashing of teeth and almost enough to kill you to do it, but is there anything you're unwilling to forgive for? Yeah. She said you would have a very hard time forgiving somebody who would kidnap, sexually abuse, ultimately murder your child. Yeah. And I can understand that. I think that would be a long, slow, hurtful, painful process. But are you saying that you wouldn't be willing to struggle with it? But I think that's a good point. Is it conditional that Christ will only forgive our sins if we are willing to forgive other people's sins? I've wrestled with that a lot, and I don't believe the Lord's Prayer is setting up a condition that says God will only forgive us as we are willing to forgive, because that says then that God's forgiveness is only extended to us to the limited degree that we as human beings will forgive. And it's kind of like a payback system. If I forgive you, then God will forgive me. So But God isn't going to forgive me anything more than I'm willing to do. And I don't believe God's forgiveness is that conditional.
We got to close with the story.
My sense of interpretation of that is, it's not limited to, but in the manner that we are also. It doesn't talk about the amount or the limitation that we have of forgiveness. It rather talks about the way in which and the process by which we forgive and God forgives. Certainly. And that's where the lack of forgiveness and the resentment that we have, again, has the barrier up there, the blockage between us and God, becomes a spiritual burden. Sure. And so it's not talking about God as much as it's talking about our ability to accept. The difficult point is that I think she had a twist on it that said, God won't forgive me if I don't forgive. And I think what you're saying is that, no, God does forgive you, but when we don't forgive, we don't realize or accept God's forgiveness, but God has.
Okay, it's 3 minutes before the bell, and we agreed we have to close with this story. Alice, will you turn around and tell the chief that if the bell rings, she's to save me a place for a first lunch? I'll be telling you, it's a very important story. First, I should say that the Talmud, in Jewish tradition, a situation where one is called on to help a friend and to help an enemy at the same time, one is obliged first to go to the aid of one's enemy.